Welcome to another episode of the Mapscaping Podcast. My name is Daniel and this is a podcast for the geospatial community. My guest on the show today is Igor Baranganov. He is the CEO and co-founder of EMLID, so E-M-L-I-D, a company which started off making high-precision GNSS receivers in his kitchen and crowdfunded the first batch on Kickstarter. But that was over 10 years ago. Today, Igor is going to tell us about the innovations that made this possible, give a great explanation of RTK and PPP, and he also explains why we should not expect to see high-precision positioning on our phones anytime soon. Every time I feature a for-profit organization on the podcast, I ask them to help cover the costs of producing their episode. Some say no, and others, like EMLID, agree to help. This doesn't just make their episode possible, it makes all of the episodes possible. So thank you very much, EMLID. I really appreciate your support. Hi, Igor. Welcome to the podcast. So you are the CEO and co-founder of EMLID, and you do a couple of different things, but I think your focus is around this high-precision GNSS receivers and software, so centimeter accuracy positioning. And this is what I'm hoping to talk to you about today. You've got an interesting startup story, and you know a ton around this high-precision, high-accuracy positioning world, and I want to dive into that later on. But before we get there, would you mind just giving us a brief introduction? How did you get involved in this field? And maybe you could throw in your startup story. I believe it's something around crowdfunding.
Hey, Daniel. Thanks for having me here today. We started our company about 10 years ago. And around that time, you know, that was the moment when drones were becoming really popular. And we were working a lot with them while still being in the university. And we were building drones for mapping. And at that time, it was really important to kind of find a way how to make the maps more accurate. Essentially, when a drone is flying, you really want to, and you want to stitch the pictures together in the right way, you need to have some, what we call now ground control points. So these are some known points on the ground. So to make this ground control points, we had to use a high-precision GPS or an RTK GPS. And that's how I sort of learned about this technology. And it was something very scientific. So it was a very expensive tool that required training, that required a special separate computer to run it, and the software that ran on Windows CE. So that was all very, very intimidating for, you know, for somebody just in the university. And we were looking at that and couldn't stop thinking, like, there has to be a better way to do it. There has to be a way to do it, you know, more affordably. And maybe being a little bit naive at that time, we decided, okay, we're gonna give it a go. So basically, we were able to find a way how to make this technology that used to, you know, be accessible to only the professional surveyors, where, you know, a receiver could be easily like $20,000. We figured out how to make it way, way cheaper. So just, you know, just in my kitchen, we designed some boards, assembled them, wrote the software, and built our first GNSS receiver. And it was nothing like those receivers that we have used in the field that were rugged and had batteries and separate computers. It was just a board and some heat shrink wrap. So we had this prototype, but we really had no way to scale that. So we decided to try and launch a crowdfunding campaign to see if other people were maybe interested in the same idea. Like, is it possible to kind of have this technology available for less? So we launched a Kickstarter campaign, and our first receiver called Rich, we launched it for just $200. So that was really, really something at that time. Like, most of the people were used to having, you know, to those devices being like $20,000. And now, you know, there are these two guys working out of their kitchen and offering the same technology for $200. And there were so many people that were really excited about that. We ended up raising about $80,000. We've built our first batch of receivers using that money. And kind of our story starts from there.
If you don't mind me asking, what was the secret sauce there? How did you manage to make it so much cheaper? So you talked about like these sort of rugged devices that were available on the market for, I think you mentioned $20,000, just as an example. And you also said yours was less rugged. It was a board with some shrink wrap on top of it. So that's one way of making it cheaper. But what was it, yeah, like, were new chips suddenly available? Did you use some sort of new
processing algorithms? Was it the antenna? What was it about? Like, how did you make it so much cheaper than what was available previously?
Well, to be honest, it was possible to do it. Like, the components were out there. Well, there was open source software out there. Like, no one thing just tried to put it together as a product that other people could use. So it was out there in open source communities. In there was no Discord back then, but you know, probably these days it would have been on Discord. There were some people that were really interested in making this technology more affordable, and we found a way to kind of run it all on a small device. So I would say that our main innovation at that point was that we figured out how to run it on a really small device that you can actually put on a drone or, you know, put it in a robot. Is previously kind of you had to have a computer that ran this the software to make the calculations, and then you had to have some extra hardware for the satellite reception itself, which made it very difficult to integrate it somewhere. So we managed to put it all together in a really compact package and let other people play with it. And that's probably a moment where we can talk a little bit about the sort of what makes this technology or used to make this technology so expensive. In order to get this high accuracy in a reliable way, you need a specialized chip that can receive multiple, not just multiple satellite systems, but multiple signals on different frequencies from each satellite. And these specialized chips, they're usually called ASICs. You probably know something about ASICs, like from mining. From like Bitcoin mining, where people are making these specialized chips to mine Bitcoin really efficiently. So basically, if you want to solve some task really efficiently in a chip, at some point and for some tasks, you cannot just use a, you know, general purpose CPU. You need to use the specialized hardware, and that costs a lot of money up front. So you need to invest a lot of money into R&D to make this chip, and that's millions of dollars. So these specialized chips that were able to receive all of the signals, and the normal chip that's in your smartphone, it only receives one signal on one frequency from each satellite. So these specialized chips, they weren't really available on an open market. There were companies that have made that investment, made their chips, and then made the equipment based on these chips just for themselves. And that was their way then to basically get their money back and to get return on investment. And because the market size was quite small, so it was just surveyors and maybe some people in construction, that led to prices of the equipment being really high. Yeah, so that's kind of why it was that way, you know, approximately 10 years ago. The whole market was divided. You had your normal GPS chips for, I don't know, boats, car navigation, smartphones, and those were only working on one frequency, or they were called L1 only. They might have supported several different systems, like not just GPS, but Galileo, GLONASS, Beidou, but only on one frequency. And these were available on the market, you know, for $10, something like this, because they were produced in millions and millions every year. And then there were these specialized chips, which were developed by the companies that made survey equipment. And they have invested millions of dollars into developing these chips. And this multi-frequency capability, so to receive more than one frequency from a satellite, that was only required for this high-precision positioning and not required for the mass market. So that's why they were able to keep the prices so high, because they had this core technology locked to themselves.
And what did you do then? Did you come along and develop a new chip, or did something change within the market dynamics that meant that these chips were suddenly available? What happened?
So for a change to happen, you know, a new kind of application had to appear where this kind of high precision multi-frequency capability would be a requirement, but then there is also going to be this massive volume of millions of units, because we don't really need this kind of capability in our everyday life. And so the timing worked really well for us, because just a few years after we started, the hottest topic was autonomous cars. So I think we have already kind of forgotten about them. Now everyone talks about AI, but you know, 5 years ago, it was all about autonomous cars. And cars are interesting because they require higher accuracy than our, you know, normal everyday applications, because they want to know in which lane they are, and they want to know it really reliably. So maybe they didn't actually need this like 1 centimeter accuracy, but they wanted to have really robust lane level accuracy, so to know in which lane you are. And that required this multi-frequency capability to do it really, really, really reliably. And autonomous cars are a massive market. So the suppliers for cars that weren't previously interested in this technology have invested the money and developed the chipsets that were available to everyone and much cheaper. So it's very interesting how this technology has evolved. It started with this really specialized use case in survey, then, you know, and then it was really expensive and only for a very limited market. And then that migrated to a much broader market in autonomous cars, which made it so much more affordable and even more robust because, you know, these companies can invest so much more, actually. And what we have done is we have migrated these benefits of really matured high-precision positioning for autonomous cars. We have migrated that back to surveyors and construction professionals, you know, and GIS and drones, so that now they can benefit from having even, you know, more robust positioning, and it's now much more affordable. So that's kind of the path that the technology has taken. Our path in it is like a lot more complex, but I think that's a really good kind of high level overview of what has happened there.
Yeah, I agree. And I really appreciate that. I think that it's going to add a lot of context to what I'm hoping to sort of move off and talk about now. I want to come back to this broader market appeal that you were talking about or hinted at just before, but I think we should leave that to later on in the episode. Right now, I want to focus on this idea of precise positioning and high accuracy positioning. When I talk to people like you, and I do this too, I use those words almost interchangeably. Is this a mistake that we make? You know what I mean? Like in the same way we talk about GNSS, but we call it GPS. Is this just a way of talking about it? Or is one of these things more important than the other? Or maybe you could just break this down a little bit for me. When we talk about survey level or survey grade GNSS positioning, is precision more important, or are we actually after accuracy? How do we tease these two things apart?
I really wish I could, you know, I could draw a picture right now, but it's a podcast. So
maybe I can help here. So what I prepared, something I prepared earlier. So I've got this image on my screen here, and it's four targets. Yes. And you know, and you know exactly where I'm going. So the left-hand side, the upper left is low accuracy, low position. There's, you know, dots on the target that they're spread out all over the place. There's no real pattern. It's just all over the place. We move from left to right at the top end of this image, and it says low accuracy, high position. So the dots all clump together, but they're nowhere near the center of the target. High accuracy, low position, the dots are around the center of the target, but there's no clear pattern. It looks a bit random, but they're much closer to the center of the target than what they were before. And high accuracy, high precision, all of the dots are in this great pattern in the center of the target, which maybe I should include this visual with that with the podcast. But getting back to my question, oftentimes we talk about this high accuracy or high precision when we talk about GNSS. When we do that, is one better than the other? Is one more desirable than the other? Or what we really want is both? Are we just using this for as like a pseudo for both of these things?
I think you're right. Like we tend to just use both terms interchangeably, even though if we dive a bit deeper into applications, then there might be differences. So for example, with drone mapping, when using high precision, we will say high precision GPS or high accuracy GPS, but then sometimes like with this technology, you'll always have high precision. But you might not always get high accuracy. And then there are some applications where it's fine, and then there are applications that are sensitive to it. So, for example, if you're making a drone map and you really want to get boundaries or some survey-grade results, a result out of it, then you absolutely want it to be really accurate. I mean, on a country level, you want to know exactly where this is. You not just want it to be aligned to itself, you want it to align to kind of to the broader reference system. But if we're talking about something like measuring volumes, for example, here you might not really be that worried about, you know, your stockpile being shifted one way or the other as long as the volume is correct. So in that context, you know, from kind of the drone mapping perspective, sometimes high precision is enough and high accuracy is not really required.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. really appreciate those examples. That was a great way of describing it, you know, on an audio podcast as well. Congratulations to you. We've talked about this centimeter resolution, and we've also mentioned survey grade accuracy when we talk about positioning. Is there some kind of magic cutoff point here? Like, is everything over 5 or under 5 centimeters, is that, you know, high grade accuracy? Or is there any way of sort of like partitioning this into low accuracy, high accuracy? Is there any sort of magic number where we can say, ah, anything over or below a centimeter in terms of resolution is high accuracy?
Oh, well, the devil is really in the details. So when we're talking about centimeter accurate GPS, okay, is it like, how accurate is it actually? And then depending on which metric you use, it might be a different number. So are we going to talk about, you know, RMS, or are we going to talk about SEP or something else? But in general, I would say that high precision GPS with RTK, you can expect to be within 1 centimeter as long as your reference station is not too far away and the conditions are favorable, so you have a good sky view. So that's kind of where this technology in general, tends to land in terms of accuracy. And then the further you go from your reference station, you know, the worse the conditions are, you might end up with less precise results. But in general, sort of in GPS, we tend to distinguish this like 1 centimeter class devices, submeter class devices, so that kind of are used for locating things, and then just your normal GPS in a smartphone, which is depending on the conditions again, but like probably within 5 meters. So these are the kind of classes that are in terms of accuracy that are out there. So this whole submeter thing is kind of dying because the smartphones are becoming better on one hand, so they are getting closer to that precision grade. And on the other hand, the centimeter accuracy is becoming more affordable. So, if you can have centimeter accuracy for the same price and complexity as you have your submeter accuracy, why not just have centimeter accuracy? And, you know, we have plenty of cases like that. For example, there is a company, you know, they have some valves on the gas network. And previously, they were using submeter GPS to locate their assets, and that was enough most of the time. But then what if they want to know, you know, on which side of the pipeline is the junction box? And then here you want to be more accurate than just submeter. You want to be within a centimeter. And then if you can have your centimeter accuracy everywhere, again, why not just do everything at this accuracy? It just used to be that it was really, really expensive to measure with 1 centimeter accuracy, and it was much more affordable to measure with submeter accuracy. And now there is pretty much no point in not using high precision.
When we talk about like achieving this centimeter level accuracy, high precision as you called it, you talked previously about the chipset. So now that we have access to these chips that are capable of processing dual frequencies, that has made a huge leap forward. What kind of impact do the other parameters have? And when I say parameters, I'm thinking about things like the antenna, the software that's processing this data, the ability to look at signals from multiple different constellations, perhaps an IMU. Are those things, are they a necessity when we talk about sub-centimeter resolution? Or are there any one of those things that make a bigger difference than the others?
So essentially, the system has, several critical components. So the first one in the signal processing chain, you know, in the signal reception chain, is the antenna. And for high precision, we want really specific types of antennas, and I will kind of get back to that. Then there is the receiver itself that produces what we call raw data, typically. So it's just ranges to the satellites and phase measurements, so kind of parameters of the signal that help us understand that help us after that calculate the position, and then the processing engine that actually makes the magic happen and outputs the position to the system downstream. And then, you know, there is a bunch of different stuff that you need to make it all work, like, you know, batteries and Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and, you know, enclosure, but that's kind of how a receiver is built. So with the antenna, we wanted to have certain properties. So first of all, we wanted to receive as much of the energy as possible so that we can get a really clean signal with minimal noise. That's kind of the goal of the antenna. But there is another issue with antennas is that we want them to be very stable no matter where the signal is coming from. And these antennas, they could be pretty big. So if you want to receive signals from multiple constellations, multiple frequencies really well, you want an antenna that is approximately the size of, it would be like a small plate. And when you think about it, the antenna itself is sort of bigger than the accuracy that we're trying to achieve. So we want to make sure that we know where exactly in this antenna are we receiving our signal. And we also want this place to be very stable, no matter the orientation of the device relative to the satellites. And then the satellites also move over time. So with everything in motion, we want to make sure that this virtual point within the antenna where all the signals meet and they're measured, that it's really stable and it's more stable than the accuracy that we're trying to achieve. So it needs to be kind of on a millimeter scale at the stability of this virtual point. It's called the phase center. So the place where all the phases of signals meet. So, and this kind of antennas are quite specialized.
That is really interesting. We're going to come back to this later on. The antenna is actually bigger than the resolution of the position that we're trying to capture. I want to come back to this later on, but I appreciate that. Thanks. Could you give us, just before we move on here, can you give me a sort of brief understanding, very high level, of how RTK works? And I think it's close cousin, precise positioning. What is it, PPPK? What, are there too many P's in there?
So the precise point positioning.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Let's talk about RTK first, and then we'll get to PPP. So both RTK and PPP are a way to increase the accuracy of a GNSS system. So I think it makes sense to begin from like a normal GPS that's inside your smartphone that just receives the signals from the satellites. So how is it actually able to derive a position? Well, each satellite sends a signal in which it encodes a really precise timestamp of when this signal left the satellite. So that when the signal arrives to your phone, you can actually calculate how much time did it take for the signal to travel to your phone. And provided you have reception of signals from at least four satellites, you can actually derive your own position. That position will only be accurate to, you know, a meter or so. Now, why is it so? Like, why is it, you know, just a meter? Why can't it be better? Well, as signals travel through different layers of the atmosphere and through ionosphere, they get delayed along the way. And the issue here is that they get delayed differently in different layers. They also travel on really different paths. So you might have, you know, satellites on the left and the satellite on the right. And if you imagine the path that the signal takes from the satellite to you, it is going to go through like a completely different environment than, you know, the signal you have on the other side. And they accumulate this kind of errors as they travel. So in the end, there is some noise in the position. And what you know, the science and the industry have been trying to do is to try to somehow eliminate these errors to arrive to a position that is much more accurate, maybe 1 centimeter accurate. And then there are essentially two approaches here, RTK and PPP. So what do we do in RTK? RTK uses two receivers. One is stationary and the other is moving, typically. The one that is stationary, we call a base station or a reference. The one that is moving is called a rover, like on Mars. We can look at it this way. If you draw a line of how a signal travels from a satellite to your receiver, and you draw another one from the satellite to the base station, then they are going to be very close. You probably won't be able to distinguish between the two because the satellites are about 20,000 kilometers away from us, and your two receivers are maybe just 10 kilometers away from each other. So there is a huge difference between these distances. So this path that the satellite signal travels on, they are going to be almost the same, which means that the errors that it gets along the way, the additional delays, are going to be the same. And then you can just subtract one from the other. And this way, you will remove all the noise. You will remove all these additional delays from the signal. And that's what RTK does. It directly takes two measurements from two receivers that are not too far away from each other. and then subtracts one from the other. That's on a very sort of simplistic level. RTK also uses another important trick to achieve higher accuracy. It's called integer ambiguity resolution. So the signal that travels from the satellite towards the receiver is actually a wave. And this wave has a wavelength of about 20 centimeters. We can measure the phase in which we receive the signal. So you can think of the phase as sort of the where are you within the wave. And we can measure that with millimeter accuracy or even better. So we can measure that really, really accurately. But the challenge is that there are so many full wavelengths to the satellite, so we don't really know in which of the wavelengths we are. You can think about a mechanical clock. When you look at it, you know what time is it, but you don't know which day is it. And it's kind of the same thing with the signal. So we know the time, so we know the phase within the wavelength really accurately, but we don't know within which wave we are. And we need to be able to get to the centimeter accuracy. We need to calculate how many integer wavelengths do we have to the satellite. And that's why we call it resolving the integer ambiguity, because it's ambiguous how many wavelengths there are. Now, we don't just take the signal from one satellite. Modern receiver can track, over 50 satellites at the same time. So we have these 50 lines going to different satellites, and for all of them, you can measure, okay, I am here within a wavelength, and then how many integer wavelengths I have to that satellite, and to that satellite, and to that satellite. And this all goes into an algorithm that is able to determine that in an optimal way. So that's kind of how RTK works. It uses these two techniques. One is where we assume that the errors for two receivers are pretty much the same because the signal travels along almost the same path. And the second one is we use integer ambiguity resolution to have this really accurate measurement of the distance to the satellite.
I was a little bit nervous about asking you that question because I was wondering if I would be able to understand the answer, but I appreciate the way you broke that down. I think I'm probably going to have to listen to this a couple of times again to really sort of get my head around it. But I wanted to ask about that algorithm that you're talking about. You were talking about, let's say, 50 different lines going out, and we're trying to figure out, how do we remove the noise from them firstly? And, based on our base station and our rover, those different frequencies that we're getting or signals that we're getting to each of those. And then you talked about this integer ambiguity problem that you're also solving in RTK. And that algorithm that does that, is this a Kármán filter?
There's going to be a Kármán filter involved in that. So there are so many parameters that are going to be estimated within the receiver, and the Kármán filter is going to be used there for sure.
And just so I understand, when we say RTK, and this is happening in real time.
Mm-hmm. So there is also PPK. So PPK is the post-processing version of RTK. That's where we don't really have a real-time connection between the two receivers, but we just record data on two receivers and then bring this data together in specialized software, and then we do all this calculation to derive a trajectory. PPP is a bit of a different thing. So you remember we talked about all these different delays and signals traveling through different paths, through atmosphere and other layers. So the trick we used there was to assume that the errors are the same for two receivers that are not too far away from each other. But what if we could have a really good model of all of the layers that surround the Earth, and then to model each of these delays by knowing, where you are, where the satellite is, what is the path that the signal travels on, and then here it goes through this layer or through that layer. You can think of it as a cake that is wrapped around the Earth, and then there are different layers that behave differently. And then if we knew, how it is distributed, how are the errors distributed all around the Earth, then we would be able to calculate really precisely for each signal in each moment of time how much extra delay there is per each layer it travels through. And that's what PPP is trying to do. It's trying to build a model for a very large region, or ideally for the whole globe, that tells you exactly what are these additional errors for each signal. And once we get into this PPP future completely, we'll be able to have this up-to-date model of all the errors and then the receiver will be able to calculate a really precise position without relying on a second receiver nearby. We're still not completely there in terms of real-time performance, but this is already doable in post-processing.
Wow. So my last sort of question around the technical mechanics of how this works is, are all these things used together, or like, or are they, do you decide, okay, this is our, we're going to use this strategy or this strategy, or can I combine these strategies?
Well, in terms of positioning performance, RTK is still the king. So if you want to measure something and be really sure in accuracy and in performance in difficult conditions, and yeah, in that case, you want to use RTK. There is another advantage of RTK. It's a bit more specific, but because the reference stations are actual physical reference stations that are somewhere near you, if there is a tectonic shift, or maybe if your country is slowly drifting, like maybe Australia, then that's really good for you because your positioning is going to be drifting together with the tectonic plate. And that means that your measurements are going to be, you know, essentially in the same place year over year instead of drifting away. And that's really useful if you're trying to understand where, for example, the boundary of your land is. I'm sure you wouldn't want that to drift over time. So that's actually a very interesting challenge in high precision positioning. That, okay, what if we create, you know, these beautiful global Google Maps with 1 centimeter accuracy, and we can, you know, open our phone and there is this 1 centimeter accurate position. And for example, you're in Australia, you go, you measure the boundaries of your land, everything is fine, but you come back 10 years later and you are, you know, 30 centimeters off because the country has drifted. And that's a bit of a problem. And it's not really a problem if your GPS is accurate to 5 meters. You don't need to worry about such things. But once you get into these accuracies, yes, the fact that countries move is a problem. So that's why countries have their own frames of reference. And then all the reference stations they have installed, you know, in them, they kind of drift together with the country. So if you measure anything relative to them, you kind of get the same point on the ground year over year, even though on the, like, you know, relative to the other country, it's actually moving because your house is actually moving.
So
that's pretty wild.
That's really wild. So, but the assumption there is also that both receivers, so the base station and the rover, are moving in the same direction. I could imagine, for example, like, oh, you're on that side of the fault line, which is, you know, 10 meters away from me, and I'm on this side, and we're moving in different directions. This would definitely be the case in a lot of places in New Zealand. Like, you know, the Alpine Fault, 10 kilometers away from your base station, could have a massive impact depending on, you know, which direction you are moving.
It's really wild when I think about all of this. But that's kind of where there is a difference, you know, between this like local positioning system, which RTK is. So it's relative to something that is not too far away, even though it relies on kind of global positioning system, but it's still relative to something, to some physical infrastructure nearby. With PPP, you're trying to create a global model. And then the position that you're getting is relative to a global reference frame. And then there are ways to calculate these things. But then, you know, if you had an earthquake yesterday, the model is not likely to be updated really quickly, but the base station still moves. So, yeah, but, you know, there are many very smart people working on these challenges and making sure that the land rights are preserved no matter the earthquakes or new positioning technology.
I'm really pleased to hear you say that there's very smart people working on this, because this doesn't sound like a field for me. This sounds really complicated. So if I had to summarize this a little bit, we started off saying, okay, one of the big breakthroughs, like making this kind of like high accuracy positioning available to the mass market, was the creation of these new chips. And I think you mentioned autonomous vehicles were one of the big drivers behind this. Oh, we need to produce these things en masse. So these chips hit the market. You and your team in your kitchen figured out, oh, we can use this if we string together some open source software and shrink wrap it. We can sell this. And you did. And then you talked us through the importance of antennas, what this means, like, and we'll get to this in just a second when we think about the future of all this, like measuring where on the antenna, you know, are we actually measuring the position? I think that's going to be an interesting conversation. You walked us through RTK, PPP, and PPK. I hope I've got those acronyms right. I didn't know any of that. That was really helpful. Even I got to admit, as a geospatial professional, I hadn't heard anyone explain why it's a base station, why base stations and rovers need to work together in such a concise way as what you had done. So I really appreciate that. And then you managed to wrap it all up and say, well, this is really hard and fascinating. And I tend to agree. And I think you used the word wild a couple of times. I agree. I think this is wild. And I think one of the wildest things about this is that we completely take it for granted. We just, you know, you go outside, you turn on your phone, you're navigating somewhere. Let's say you use Google Maps, for example, and it just works. Like, it just works. And that's just the positioning side of things. I think it's also wild when we think about this as a global utility in terms of timing as well. And all, like, if it disappeared tomorrow, the problems that we would be in just because we couldn't agree on what time it was.
Yeah, we really rely on this infrastructure. I really like the term the only global utility, because when you think about it, it's really the only global utility we have that is free for everyone to access. And it's immensely useful for so many things. And when it goes down, you know, it's even in some regions, then, you know, it causes a lot of trouble. I really recommend to everyone to read the book called Pinpoint. It's a very interesting book on the history of navigation, on the history of precision, on the history of high precision GNSS in general, and on more indigenous ways of navigating the world and how they interconnect. I learned a lot from this book about GNSS. I think that's the author of this book who came up with the idea of GNSS being the only global utility. At least that's where I got it from. And just recently there was this thing in Australia where there was an incident on a satellite, and it wasn't even a positioning satellite. It was a satellite that was sending very specific type of corrections for agricultural vehicles that allows them to drive more accurately than just with normal GPS. And it stopped broadcasting the signal, and the farmers couldn't farm. So just the tractors wouldn't drive. And that's also wild, I say. Like, we have something in space that, you know, if it breaks down, we can't grow food for ourselves. I mean, how far have we gone with this?
Yeah, it is amazing. Because when I think about farming, I think of it as being one of the most analog things you can do, but it has a very intimate connection with the digital world. And like you mentioned, space, the infrastructure that we have in space. This sort of leads on to the future. And towards the end of these episodes, I like to talk about the future and give people an idea of where we're going and what's possible. And I think you might be a great person to ask some questions to about the future of this. So we talked about antennas before. We talked about them being bigger, you know, than the positioning accuracy we were trying to collect. So if I have an antenna that's the size of, you know, a small plate, for example, how the hell am I going to capture sub-centimeter accuracy, positioning accuracy using that? And this leads me to the idea of using cell phones as a sub-centimeter positioning tool. Is this a future that's possible to get to?
It might be that we'll get there. It doesn't, like, definitely the accuracy in smartphones is improving. I just don't think that we'll see, like, this highest accuracy, so like 1 centimeter grade accuracy in smartphones, you know, within next 5 years or so. And there are some fundamental physical reasons for that. So as we talked before, an antenna is something that is really, like, a good antenna is something that is really crucial for high precision positioning. And there just isn't any space in a smartphone to place such an antenna. And I don't think that the manufacturers will see enough value in this kind of feature in a smartphone, you know, to make it much bigger and to add a bigger battery for it to be able to do all these calculations all the time. So there are two main factors. One is the size of the antenna to achieve high precision, and the other is the power consumption required to continuously track so many signals. And if on the power consumption side, maybe there could be some kind of a compromise and then the technology could develop. But with antennas now, it's looking really challenging. And it's not just about being able to receive the signals, but it's also about the stability of the phase center. So we tend to, you know, not hold our phones like horizontally or like strictly vertical all the time. We just, you know, rotate them as we please. And then depending on the change of the orientation, we rotate them with different sides towards the satellite. And when we think about the size of the smartphone, and even if we had some kind of new antenna technology that would be able to receive the signals really well within such a compact device, it would be really difficult to achieve high stability of the face center. So where are we actually receiving this signal depending on how our smartphone is oriented towards the satellite? And then the smartphone moves, the satellite moves, everything is in motion. How do we know where exactly within the smartphone we're receiving the signal? And the smaller the antenna is, kind of the more difficult that is, they become more more tricky to get stable. So I would say that we are really limited by the antenna size and the antenna performance to achieve this accuracy. And even if you had a way to make this antenna with really high stability of the face center, it would even be difficult to measure with the smartphone, because how would you know, you know, which part of this smartphone you should, you know, put on a point, like because the smartphone is bigger than the accuracy with which we're trying to measure. So it's not really an optimal device to measure with this accuracy.
I was just thinking too, in the variation in devices. So my phone is a different size to my wife's phone, for example. Our kids have there is a slightly different physical size to the phone. And I think about all those different variations that you might have to, you know, think about when you're running software on these devices to figure out, well, where is the center of this thing?
Yeah. And for survey applications, there is a special procedure that you do that is called antenna calibration. So as a GNSS device developer, which we are, you send your device to a special lab or to their governmental agencies that can perform this calibration. Then they put your receiver on a robotic arm, and this robotic arm, over a course of many hours, rotates the receiver into every possible orientation relative to each satellite. And then, because it's a very precise robotic arm, it knows the exact position where your receiver is at any point in time. It can then compare what is the receiver showing relative to where it actually is, depending on the angle of the satellite.
Wow.
So and they produce a special calibration model, and that's how we can push the accuracy, you know, even further. And all the kind of professional survey grade devices, they would be calibrated this way. So yeah, we really care about the stability of our face centers.
Yeah, and it seems unlikely people are going to do that with cell phones. Appreciate your input, your insights there. So the next question I wanted to ask you was around comparing GNSS to visual positioning. Recently, I saw an article on LinkedIn, I think it was, where in the headline, it was a fantastic headline. It got a lot of clicks. It was GNSS is dead. Visual positioning is the new, you know, king kind of thing. Could you help us understand perhaps sort of brief overview of the differences between those two things and where we should be using one over the other, and if visual positioning is going to make GNSS redundant in the future?
Well, yeah, saying that something is dead is a sure way to get a lot of clicks. So there is definitely a new way of positioning with visual systems. And if I understand correctly what you're talking about, then it's this new technology where you can basically have a full 3D representation of the world around you. And then you can compare what you're seeing to the model that you have stored in the memory of your device, and then understand where you are. Sort of like, I don't know, do you play GeoGuessr? Then
yeah, I have done in the past. Yeah, yeah.
So think about your smartphone doing that, but you know, much faster, and probably with better results. Definitely better results than I was able to achieve there. So if it has this full digital representation of the world around you, and it can, you know, very quickly find what it sees right now, then it can derive your position. And it sounds great for big cities, but, you know, it's going to be very challenging for remote areas, for areas that don't have so many features. Like, imagine you are in a cornfield, like every feature around you is going to look exactly like, you know, exactly the same. So you look left, you see corn. You look right, you see corn. Like, there is no way to use that to understand where you are. You're in a cornfield. That's the best accuracy you get. In a city, it's going to be different, right?
I could also imagine in a city, like an urban environment, it's possibly going to change less over time. So those buildings are likely to be there next year as well, where cornfields, so, you know, and vegetation is going to grow and shrink and die off and come again in the spring kind of thing. And also, I just can't imagine people building really accurate models of rural environments in the same way that they might do for urban environments.
Yeah, it's probably not going to be worth the investment, but that's where these two technologies are going to be complementing each other really well. So GNSS, in general, urban environment is challenging for GNSS because you have so many reflections from building around you. The buildings are obstructing the sky view. So it's going to be great to be able to augment the GNSS positioning with visual positioning in urban areas. In remote areas, it's not going to make sense to use visual positioning, but there you can rely on GNSS, and it's such perfect conditions for GNSS. And the same thing is going to be, you know, in the air or at sea.
That's a really good point. Yeah, we need to also navigate in those environments where there's very little to look at, very little detail in the landscape. What about a world where, you know, GNSS, you talked about this, these two technologies augmenting each other. Is there a world where we don't need to send people out into the field anymore to measure things? You know, we don't need surveyors measuring things because we get the accuracy that we need, you know, by using these two technologies together?
It could be. I would say that for many of the jobs where previously you would send a person to measure something, we would no longer do that. So especially if it's about measuring things. So previously it could take a lot of time to create a map of something, for example. Yeah, because you need to go out there and actually measure, you know, walk everywhere and measure all the features. But now you can just fly a drone and, you know, create a map in hours instead of weeks, which improved the efficiency so much. But then there are the types of jobs where you need to locate something. For example, you want to understand, okay, you know, this pile goes in there, and then you actually need to send the person to mark things up. Or to install something. And yeah, in that case, we're probably still going to use some kind of high precision positioning device to guide this person to the place where they need to install something. But yeah, it's like increasingly we are getting better at remote sensing the world and creating higher accuracy maps of everything.
I guess when I heard you answer my question, it occurred to me that maybe I should have used the words optical measurements. Could any of these technologies that we've been talking about today make that redundant, these optical measurements? You know, we see the surveyor looking through the theodolite and making a measurement.
So GNSS is really, like, it really depends on the type of a job. But in general, for some types of jobs, GNSS definitely is replacing all these kind of classic ways of measuring things with total stations, so where you are measuring distances and angles rather than measuring your absolute position on Earth. And it's clear that GNSS is so much faster if you need to, you know, create a map of something, create a topographic survey, for example. But if you need that really high accuracy, so if you need to be really confident, if you're in construction, for example, and you need to be reliably sub-centimeters, so maybe your error budget is just a few millimeters, there you still rely on classical measurements, distances and angles. And then also if you need to go into a mine or into a tunnel, yeah, no luck using GNSS there. So
good point.
These kind of instruments are here with us to stay, but they're definitely becoming less popular and more of a niche tool for very specific jobs. And GNSS is taking over most of the things because it's just so much faster. Yeah, because you get the coordinate right away out of it. You don't need to, like, if you can only measure distances and angles, then first you need to find some kind of a point that you can begin with, of which a coordinate is known, and then from there you can start your measurements. So that's really time consuming. And with GNSS, you just turn it on and, you know, you can read the coordinate. That's it. Sort of your local benchmarks.
I think this would be a great time to sort of round off the conversation, Igor, because you have been brilliant. I want to be careful with your time here. So I just want to say thanks. I really enjoyed this conversation. You've helped me understand a lot more about GNSS. And I can tell you that I'll be listening to this episode again a couple of times myself, just to try and get my head around some of the concepts that you've walked us through today. So I really appreciate it. If there's people listening to this, there will be people listening to this thinking, how can I reach out to this person? Is there anywhere we can send them if they want to connect with you personally or check out what it is that you're working on?
Yep, sure. Just you can go to hamlet.com and check out what we're doing, or you can find me on LinkedIn and message me and we can talk.
Okay. Oh, you said that really fast. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes of this episode so you can find it. And I'll also put a link into your LinkedIn profile. Really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for showing up today.
Thanks, Daniel. It was a pleasure.
I really hope you enjoyed that episode with Igor, CEO and co-founder of Emlyn. I'll put links to where you can check out the company and, of course, connect with Igor in the show notes of this episode. We have also published a bunch of episodes around GNSS, and so there will be some recommended listing in the show notes as well if you're interested. But that's it for me. That's it for this week's episode of the Mapscaping Podcast. I hope that you will take the time to join me again soon.